Well, tonight we are entering the third phase of the trial of Jesus Christ. The first two phases of this trial took place behind closed doors. Jesus was hauled before the Sanhedrin, the Jewish council, in chapter 14, verses 53 to 65. After that, he was then hauled before Pilate, the Roman governor, in chapter 15, verses 1 to 5, which we read a moment ago. And behind these closed doors, the sense of injustice was palpable. There were no fair trials here. These were people who were out to get him for their own personal reasons. And perhaps part of us thinks then that at this point, what is needed is for us to leave those shady rooms and to get out into the fresh air of the public space. And surely what we need is to encounter the common sense of the ordinary people. And surely what will happen then is, finally, it's a chance for the multitudes to vindicate their king and go back on all of those unjust decisions which have been made a moment ago. Jesus just needs a healthy bit of democracy. He needs the voice of the common people who have supported him up until now. He needs them to help him in his hour of need. Well, in Mark chapter 15, verses 6 to 15, the trial of Jesus does now enter that public space, but vindication is not achieved for Jesus. And our passage ends with the crowds shouting, "Crucify," and with Jesus being delivered over to death. So how did we get here then? Why such injustice from the people? Well, this evening I want us to look at three forces which conspire together in this passage against Jesus and ultimately force him to his death. And this is the first one: Pilate's power. Pilate's power. You know, things have gotten serious when Jesus of Nazareth, this poor son of a carpenter, finds himself in the presence of Pontius Pilate, the governor of Judea, the highest official in the land. Pilate is our representative of Rome, of the Roman Empire, of imperial power, of Babylon, metaphorically speaking. And the Roman Empire is not just one nation among many other nations. It is the superpower of the day. It is, I suppose we could say, the highest expression of collective human power. It stretches from Britain in the north to Africa in the south, from Syria in the east to Spain in the west. One in every four people living on earth live under Roman law. And Pilate is the spokesman for that. Pilate here is the sword bearer. Pilate is that representative of ultimate human power. And I want us to consider then, firstly this morning, how Pilate, as that imperial representative, as that representative of human power, how he relates to this little Jesus of Nazareth. And perhaps the first thing to say is that it is easy to read this passage and sense a little bit of reluctance on the part of Pilate in crucifying Jesus. And I think that reluctance is definitely there. Pilate asks the question at the end of the passage in verse 14, "Why? What evil has he done?" You know, Pilate has found no guilt in Jesus, and yet he has seen that these chief priests do have personal motivations for killing Jesus. In verse 10, he sees their envy. And then when we look at the other Gospels, we see that reluctance even more. So in Matthew's Gospel, we're told that Pilate's wife comes to Pilate because she's had a dream about Jesus, and she wants Pilate to have nothing to do with Jesus. Or in Luke's Gospel, we see that Pilate actually does attempt to, in a manner of speaking, release Jesus on several occasions, but they all fail. And then in John's Gospel, we're even told that at one point, Pilate is afraid of Jesus. So there is a real sense of reluctance here, I think. But nevertheless, however reluctant Pilate might feel about this whole thing, his reluctance is not strong enough to alter the fact that he will crucify Jesus. You see, this man, he does have the power to release Jesus. If anyone has the power to release him, it's Pilate. At least that's what Pilate thinks. Pilate says in John's Gospel, "Do you not know that I have the authority to release you and the authority to crucify you?" It's almost a brag. It is a brag on Pilate's part. And that same kind of sense of confident authority is there in this passage as well. I think it's in Pilate's words there in verse 9, where he says to them, "Do you want me to release for you the King of the Jews?" And then again in verse 12, "What shall I do with the man you call the King of the Jews?" As Pilate likes to keep on reminding us, he alone has the power to release Jesus and to crucify Jesus. And ultimately, Pilate uses that power to crucify Jesus. So at the very least, at the very best, I suppose, the best thing we can say is that Pilate is indifferent to Jesus. He has the power to release him, but he chooses not to. He is indifferent. But probably I think we can go even further than that. I think we can see in this passage a darker side to Pilate's behaviour. I think there's a sense in which Pilate has such power that it's inflated him, and it's left him with an inflated view of himself. And I think we see that in this passage. Because this whole affair between Pilate and the crowds, it sort of feels like a bit of a pantomime setup, doesn't it? You know, you see how Pilate asks that question in verse 9. "Do you want me to release him?" It's almost as if he's sort of hovering Jesus over the Jewish crowd like a mouse being hovered over a cat, just keeping him just out of reach, threatening to release him, threatening to pull him back from their clutches. As if to say, I thought you wanted me to release him, didn't you? And for the crowd to then sort of respond, "Oh no, we didn't." And then that leading question in verse 12, "Then what shall I do with the man you call the King of the Jews?" "Crucify him," the crowds reply. "Why?" he sort of comes back at them. "Crucify him, crucify him," they shout all the louder. "Well, if you say so." So I think he's sort of playing with this crowd a little bit. He's toying with them. He's enjoying being up there on that stage. Even this whole practice of getting the crowd to choose between Barabbas and Jesus, it reminds us of that other Roman practice in the Colosseum, where the emperor would get the crowd to pick which gladiator lived and which gladiator died. He's enjoying himself up here. He's flaunting his power. And so at the very best, I think Pilate is indifferent to Jesus, but at worst, Jesus is a plaything for Pilate. He is Pilate's opportunity for a bit of fun. And yes, Pilate may have some hesitations, some degree of reluctance, some little misgivings there under the surface, but that doesn't stop him from having his fun and from working up the crowd and getting high on power. You see, either way, ultimately for Pilate, Jesus is of very little consequence in the world. He's of very little consequence to the matters of empire, and he's of very little consequence to the matters of Pilate himself. And Pilate wants to keep it that way. This is just a Jewish squabble. I'm above this. And he wants to see this Jewish squabble much like the Roman officials in the book of Acts often see those Jewish squabbles as something which is just peripheral, something irrelevant, something ultimately inconsequential and below him. And so he might be a little bit perturbed. He might be a little bit confused by this dream which his wife has had. He might be a bit conflicted. But in the main, he just wants to shrug off all of these doubts and get on with his job and maintain what should be so obvious that he is the Roman governor, and that Jesus, at worst, is a minor pest. That he is in charge and Jesus is not. And if that means crucifying this man, although he might have some misgivings about that, that's okay because Pilate's in charge. And I do think that Mark at this point is giving us an insight into world power generally. Because I think this is how world leaders, on the whole, throughout history, relate to Jesus Christ. Yes, perhaps in private moments, those politicians, those world leaders will be wondering, something like Pilate was, you know, who is this man really? But in the main, on the whole, the empire and most world powers throughout history, I think, will simply just try to keep above this man. If they can keep him in his place and keep themselves in their place, then that's good enough for them. And if that means introducing a few restrictions here on evangelism, if that means locking up a few Christian extremists in prison, if that means occasionally going a bit further than that, then that's all right, so long as we remain in charge and they don't. Now, I want to say something at this point to all of us in this room this evening, because all of us, or some of us rather, have different experiences when it comes to relating to the state than others of us. And there will come a day, speaking historically now, when the Roman Empire will see Christianity as something not quite as harmless as Pilate did. And in that day, persecution will come, and the policy of turning a blind eye to religious squabbles will have to come to an end. And I'm very conscious that some people in this room, to some extent, are living in that day already. You know already what it's like to get on the wrong side of a man like Pilate. You know, to some extent, what it's like to be frowned on by Rome. Others of us are not in that position. We don't really know what difficult persecution looks like. But even for those of us who are not in that position, and who are not yet experiencing persecution really, Pilate's power, metaphorically, can still be an intimidating thing for us, can't it? Even here in the UK, we Christians find ourselves feeling rather small. Even just the simple fact that right now, politicians are marching around Whitehall, holding important meetings, and making world-changing decisions, and Jesus Christ, well, Jesus Christ is the last person on their minds. He might be an expletive on their lips, but really to them, Jesus and his church are hardly relevant to those big political affairs. We are just pawns on their chessboard. And what do we make of that? Well, it troubles us, shouldn't it? The very fact of Pilate's power, the fact that he looks so strong and so intimidating and so immovable compared to our silly little affairs down here, that troubles us. He might not be hostile to us, he might be simply indifferent to us, but we're troubled. Well, whoever we are and whatever our situation, I want you just to take some comfort in a couple of these verses here in this passage. Look back at verses 9 and 12. And I'm just referring to those two verses here because twice in this passage, in verses 9 and 12, Pilate refers to Jesus as the King of the Jews, or the man you call the King of the Jews. And again, I think from Pilate's perspective, he's probably provoking the crowd a little bit. He's working them up. He's getting them to boo. He's getting them to say, in effect, he's no king of ours. What do you mean, the King of the Jews? We don't have a king. Jesus is not our king. But I think for us, Mark wants us to read those words and to see the irony. The irony is that Pilate does not realize the level of truth which is coming out of his lips right now. And for us, as Mark's readers, we hear those words of his, King of the Jews, and I think Mark wants us to smile a little bit. Because actually we know something that Pilate doesn't know. We know that those words are true. And that Jesus is king, and that ultimately he is not the irrelevant person standing on that stage with Pilate. Pilate is, in the grand scheme of things. Pilate is the peripheral person. He's the irrelevant person. He's the irrelevant person in this story. And the same remains true when we look out across the political landscape around us today. We feel so small. Our King Jesus just seems like a figment of our imaginations at times. But the reality is far from the truth. And then I would add this one point. And I would say to you this, that if you do know persecution, and that if your leaders have gone beyond indifference, and if they do become hostile, and if you do know what it's like to face persecution for the name of Jesus, then realize this. It's only because your leaders are starting to realize that Jesus is not the plaything they first thought he was. It's because they're starting to realize the truth of his kingship and his power and his supreme importance. Those facts are starting to dawn on them. And that should be a source of comfort for you this evening. And when your leaders see you praying towards heaven, praying to the Father, and you're praying to him, yours be the kingdom, the power, and the glory, they're starting to realize to themselves, perhaps there might be some truth in those words. Perhaps Jesus is not as weak as we first thought he was. So take comfort in that. This man Pilate, he thinks he's in charge, but he scarcely realizes the truth he is speaking. This is the King of the Jews. So, Pilate's power. Pilate's power. That's the first thing which sees Jesus to his death. But then secondly, the priest's pride. The priest's pride. It's funny that up until this point in the story, the chief priests have been trying to find ways of making Jesus look worthy of death. And one of the ways in which they've done that is by trying to make Jesus look like a political threat. So back in chapter 15, verse 1, before they take Jesus to Pilate, there's this consultation takes place with the elders and the scribes and the whole council. And really what it seems like is happening there is that they're discussing amongst themselves, how do we proceed? In what manner do we present Jesus now to Pilate? We're about to go to Pilate, what do we say about him? Well, what's the first question that Pilate asks of Jesus in verse 2? He says, "Are you the King of the Jews?" It's the first time we've heard that kind of language in the Gospel of Mark. And it seems like the implication is that these chief priests have decided to present Jesus in this way as a man who claims to be king because it makes him look like a political threat. Jesus threatens uproar and violence, so he is clearly worthy of death. That's the kind of claim they're making, and that's what they hope Pilate will buy into and respond to. But Pilate isn't convinced. And I think actually Pilate has a clever way of seeing through all of this. In verse 7, the people, we're told that the people customarily come before Pilate and they ask for a prisoner to be released. And this seems to be a custom among the Romans. And notice who Pilate presents to them for release. He presents Barabbas. The people are presented with a choice. Either they can release Jesus or they can release Barabbas. And who is Barabbas? Well, Barabbas is a murderer. He's a man who, we're told in verse 7, has committed murder in the insurrection. It's referring to some well-known uprising or rebellion that we don't really know about right now, but that's what's being referred to. It's clearly common knowledge at the time that Mark wrote this gospel. So of all the people who we could really call a political threat, it would be Barabbas. And this is the man which is now being presented before this crowd. And yet what happens in verse 11? Look at what happens in verse 11. The chief priests of all people stir up the crowd to release Barabbas instead. So you see the hypocrisy that Pilate has exposed with presenting Barabbas. For all their claims that Jesus is a political threat, when a real political threat is presented to them, when a murderer and a real rebel appears on the scene, the chief priests would rather release him than release Jesus. Jesus, who everybody can see, is a very icon of peace. Jesus, who teaches love for enemies and turning the other cheek and frequently refuses to pursue political power even when people try to press that on him. Jesus has refused that consistently. And yet, these chief priests are stirring up the crowd to release the real rebel, the real threat. So clearly these men don't really care about political threats to the empire. So if that's not their real concern, if that's not the real reason these priests are opposed to Jesus, well, what is it then? What is the thing which really is getting these priests worked up? Why do they find Jesus really so offensive at the end of the day? Well, Pilate tells us, doesn't he? Pilate perceives it, and Mark tells us in verse 10. For he perceived that it was out of envy that the chief priests delivered him up. The chief priests envied Jesus. That was the real problem. It wasn't with Jesus, it was with themselves. It was their own pride. That was the problem. The priests' pride is the problem here. Now, think about what it meant to be a priest in Israel, let alone a chief priest. It was to have a noble task, wasn't it? To handle holy things, to minister in the holy place, in the temple, to implement the law. To be a priest was to be a mediator between man and God, to present the people before their God. To be a priest was a noble task with noble responsibilities. And perhaps the most noble thing about it was that it actually anticipated the Messiah himself. To be a priest was to be a mini Christ, a shadow, a foretaste of the great heavenly priest, the one true mediator between man and God, Jesus Christ himself. When these priests did their job well, the glory of none other than Christ himself shone through them. And yet here we are in Mark 15, and we have these chief priests of Israel, and we have the chief priest of Israel, Jesus Christ himself. And what do we see? Do we see the priests falling down and saying, you know, you are the one that we were waiting for. You are the one that we were building up to. You are the one in whom our offices are fulfilled. We are the shadow. You are the substance. No, that's not how they respond. They respond with envy. They are proud. Christ's glory is a cause of envy in these priests. To put it bluntly, they realized that Jesus was better than them, and they didn't like it. These priests were important people in Israel. They worked hard. They'd learnt the law. They had earned the respect of the people. They'd fought hard for their status, their religious authority. And now this Jesus comes along, and he's from Nazareth of all places, and he's the son of a carpenter. And by the time he's a 12-year-old boy, he already knows more than the elders. And by the time he's a 30-year-old man, he has this big crowd of disciples around him. And he has the love and the devotion and the respect of many people. And the closer one gets to this man, the more one discovers that he is perfect in every way. And that is the very thing they hate. They realize that Jesus is better than them, and they don't like it. It hurts their pride. And so they stir up the crowds in verse 11, and they get Barabbas released instead of Jesus, and they have Jesus crucified. And you know, in doing that, in killing Jesus, in stirring up the crowds, they are contradicting their entire role as priests in the first place, aren't they? You know, a priest was supposed to present the people before God, to bridge the human-divine relationship, to restore the division which exists between man and God. And yet here they are whipping up the crowds, putting in them a killing spirit, positively encouraging the division between man and God, becoming, as it were, an obstacle between the people and their God. They're contradicting their whole offices. And the driving force behind that is envy. It's pride. I want to present you with a very simple fact this evening. And I think how we deal with this fact says a lot about who we are. And this is a fact that perhaps I should address particularly at those who are involved in Christian ministry, but really it's for all of us as well. Jesus Christ is better than you. He is a greater human being. His devotion to God is better than yours. His devotion to God's word is better than yours. His love for the lost is greater than yours. He has an authority that you can never have. He has a bigger role in history than you can ever have. He obeys God's law to the very, very end and performs the greatest act of heroism. He is the saviour of the universe, and you are not. And as for yourself, left to yourself, your role in this universe would be entirely negative. You are not this man's equal. He is better than you. That is just a simple fact, and I want you to confront it and process it and face up to it and ask yourself, how do I respond to it? And when you properly confront that fact, I don't think there are many ways you can respond to it. I think perhaps there are only two ways you can respond to it. You can either adore Jesus for his superior greatness and love him for it, or else you can envy Jesus for his superior greatness and hate him for it. You can either belittle yourself under Jesus and happily assume that position of inferiority for all eternity, or you can proudly rear yourself up like a big peacock and stand your ground like those high priests do and make sure that Jesus never gets above you. And I just want to remind you this evening that being a Christian means belonging to that first category. It means swallowing your pride. It means dropping all personal claims to greatness. It means falling on your feet. It means worshipping this 30-year-old son of a carpenter that we meet in the scriptures. And if you do that, I'm telling you, you will be eternally better off and happier forever and ever. So we're looking at three forces which conspire against Jesus and send him to his death. And the first is Pilate's power, the second is the priest's pride. And then thirdly and finally, I want us to see the people's passion. The people's passion. I want to finish by drawing our attention to the crowd itself, this crowd that we're told comes up to Pilate in verse 8. Now, crowds in the Gospel of Mark play a prominent role. Before Mark chapter 10, Mark refers to crowds nearly 40 times as a significant feature of Christ's ministry in Galilee. But what exactly Mark wants us to think about these crowds is not quite clear. You see, in Mark, the crowds are a sort of ambiguous force. You might think it's just really, really good that Jesus draws all of these people to himself and has all of this attention. But actually, it's not quite like that in the Gospel of Mark. The crowds are also a source of chaos. So we're looking way back at the beginning of this book now. We're going back a couple of years. But you may remember that in chapter 1, the crowds prevented Jesus from moving about as he would like. He can't enter towns openly because of the crowds. He's forced out to desolate places. And then in chapter 2, we see the crowds sort of filling this house and people have to get in only through the roof. And it's not an ideal situation at all. And then in chapter 3, Jesus actually gets his disciples to get a boat for him so that he can avoid being crushed by the crowds. That's what he says. And then later on, he's actually prevented from eating happily because of the crowds. And then later on in that chapter, his family see these big crowds and they say of Jesus, he's out of his mind. So the crowds are not entirely good news for Jesus. They have this kind of mob enthusiasm. So much so that they end up being a threat to Jesus' ministry, even when they're happily following him and wanting him to perform miracles and that kind of thing. And so for that reason, Jesus has this uncertain relationship with the crowds. Sometimes he has compassion on them, as we're told in the feeding of the 4,000 back in Mark chapter 8. But on other occasions, he just wants to get out of their way. He's not like the pop star who loves to go up onto the stage and soak up all the praise for himself and enjoy the cheers of all his fans. No, actually, Jesus is wary of that kind of enthusiasm. And perhaps here in chapter 15, we see something of why Jesus might be wary of that enthusiasm. And it's because mob enthusiasm is actually a very fickle thing. It's volatile. It's changeable. It can easily flip. It can get out of control. And actually, it can be used as a force for evil. Enthusiastic, passionate support of Jesus can easily flip over into enthusiastic, passionate anger against him. And we see in this passage, and we've seen this evening, both Pilate and the chief priests doing the same thing. They're working these crowds. They're getting the crowds excited. They're getting their blood pumping. They're getting them to shout louder and louder, like pop stars working up their fans, but this time they're wanting to kill the man who's on the stage. Now, I'm not saying necessarily that the crowds that followed Jesus enthusiastically are the same crowds that call for his death. You know, we sang those words, sometimes they strew his way and his sweet praises sing, resounding all the day, hosannas to their king, then crucify is all their breath, and for his death they thirst and cry. Personally, I think the crowds that celebrate Jesus as he enters into Jerusalem and shout hosanna are different to the crowds we meet here. But I do think that hymn captures a truth which Mark also wants us to see in chapter 15. Because we do see here this disturbing, shocking flip between the mob enthusiasm of the crowds in general and this mob rage of the crowds that we see now. The crowds, as a sort of nebulous force, now turn on Jesus. They come after him, not as their hero, but as their victim. And I called this point the people's passion, because what was once sort of passionate, heartfelt, enthusiastic, emotional support for Jesus now becomes this passionate hatred of the man. And they're shouting, crucify, crucify. It's particularly shocking to find a Jewish crowd shouting those words. The punishment which was so barbaric, so anti-Jewish. Possibly they thought they could get away with it because the Romans were doing the dirty job, not them. And so we have to understand what we're seeing here and what Mark is presenting us with here. And I think we're seeing what I said briefly at the beginning. We're seeing the rejection of Jesus Christ moving out of the shady rooms and into the open. We are watching the people as a whole en masse now hurling down condemnations upon Jesus. It's now their responsibility. It's not just Pilate, and it's not just the priests. And actually, Pilate cunningly finds ways of making that very clear in the passage. He finds ways of pinning the responsibility on these crowds. He gets the crowd to decide the sentence upon Jesus. He then gives them several opportunities to turn back. He then reminds them that Jesus is actually innocent. He hasn't really done anything. And then he gets them to finally do that final push into crucifixion. So Pilate is not allowing this crowd to pin the blame simply on him. No, it's the people's responsibility as well. And the fact is that these people are not being made evil by Pilate and the evil priests. Pilate and the priests are massaging that evil out of the people for our viewing. And I think really that the big point at this stage is this. Do not think that the crucifixion was purely the responsibility of the elite, sort of twisting the arm of the common people. No, I think Mark is showing us that the common man and the common woman bear responsibility as well. Now, I'm coming to an end now, but I want to make this application as much as I can. And I do want to be cautious about this, because it is a nuanced point. But as I've said before on other occasions, I think there is a sense in which we have to say we are all part of that crowd. I think that is an inference we can legitimately draw out from this passage. I agree with the words of the hymn, "Ashamed I hear my mocking voice call out among the scoffers." Because Mark doesn't give us any reason to think of this crowd as being particularly evil. This is not a crowd which is just made up of the Sanhedrin. No, I think this crowd is just a crowd. We're not told anything more about it. It's just like those big enthusiastic crowds at the beginning of the book, and now that same character is entering the scene again at the end of the book. It's just a crowd. And for that reason, I think we are to assume that it's made up of all kinds of people, and that includes otherwise decent people, and polite people, and smart people, and ordinary, normal people. It includes your neighbour, and the grandmother, and the baker, and the person you meet at the checkout at Morrison's, and it includes you. And that's what we have to face. And there's something about being in that crowd, surrounded by all that noise, which brings out these people's true colours. You know, we discover in that moment what is lurking down there at the bottom of the hearts of these otherwise decent people. We discover what happens when you pull back all the restrictions of common grace upon a human being. We see what man is like in all of his ugliness, and we see there our friends and our neighbours and ultimately ourselves rebelling against our Messiah. You and I are culpable for what happens on that day. Humanity sent his God to the cross. You were in that crowd because that crowd is the natural man raging against his God. I suppose as I finish, we might say that becoming a Christian means being saved from out of that crowd. Really, it means stepping out of the crowd of God's enemies and up onto that stage with Christ. And for that to happen, it requires a work of God. But let me just leave you this evening with a challenge. And my challenge is simply this: are you still part of that crowd this evening? You know, right here, you're in this church and you're surrounded by this crowd, this worshipping crowd. And in a second, you will stand up and you will sing praises to Jesus. But Mark is telling us here that that is not enough. There are people who, under certain conditions, will passionately sing praises to Jesus, and yet, under other conditions, will passionately cry out for his death. And so I simply end this evening by appealing to the depths of your hearts and your consciences and saying to you, do you really love this man? Do you really desire to have this man? If this church shrunk down to 6 or 7 people, and your closest friends gave up on the faith, and your other friends were locked up in jail, would you still want to worship and love this man? Well, I pray that we all would, and that whatever happens, and however loudly the crowds scream for the blood of Christ, that we would be able to say, not us. No, once over we were in that crowd. Once over we were enemies of God. But no more. We have been saved from it, and we are not going back. Amen.